pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate. You're listening to news, views, and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business, and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Thank you very much, Scott, for that introduction yet again. Welcome, listeners. We're up to episode 10. It's the 26th of August. It's my birthday, so send your birthday wishes on the Facebook page. And with me is Scott, the Velvet Glove. How are you going, Scott?
Happy birthday to you, Trevor. Did you and the Fist family have a nice lunch today?
We had a lovely lunch today, but...
I am pleased to hear that.
More importantly, and Scott, I think the world has conspired to give me some presents this week.
Fist, this is a week for the eternal optimists like myself. Those who, despite all the evidence, arrogantly believe that tomorrow will be better than today and the day after that will be even better than tomorrow. The tide has begun to turn.
It has.
There has been two great victories on the secular front in this last week.
Yep.
So it's your birthday. I'll shut up and let you tell the world the good news.
Well, the first one is in relation to Victoria with their religious instruction classes. So you'll remember, dear listener, that last week we played a clip where Theris had got some publicity, and unfortunately the spokesman kind of got mauled during the interview with the Sunrise program. And we were sort of saying, you know, sympathetically, well done for giving it a go, but it was a shame there was an opportunity missed. Well, that same organisation, Theris, who I said at the time is probably more active in Victoria, they've been lobbying many years to get special religious instruction out of schools. And what we're talking about here is 1 hour a week where basically evangelists come in and into a public school funded with public money and get to Bible bash the kids for an hour. And over the years it's changed from, you know, opt out to opt in and other things, but it's a despicable thing that's going on there where children are subjected to Bible bashing in a government school, and the kids who don't attend shuffled off into a little side room and told to twiddle their thumbs because they can't learn anything substantive, because that would be unfair to the kids who are in the religious class. And Theris has been campaigning against this for many, many years, and there was an announcement during the week, a bit of a shock announcement that sort of came out of the blue.
It was a bit out of the blue, it did.
Mm.
Yep.
Where basically the Andrews Labor government has come out and said that they're going to scrap, well, that program, which is run by volunteers, can no longer occur during teaching hours. They'll let it happen during lunchtime or before and after school. Now, ideally, it shouldn't even be allowed then, but good luck to them trying to get kids to volunteer for that during their lunchtime or before school. So that's really going to put the death knell on that program. And they're going to replace it instead in the curriculum with, it's kind of a bit strange, a whole range of different ideas. Tuition about addressing family violence, promoting gender equity, and also some sort of comparative look at various religions. So the sort of program that's going to replace it is definitely not a religious indoctrination program, and that is one step forward for civilization in Victoria, Scott.
And if I can just also add to that, the good thing about Furious's victory on the Southern Front is that this new program will be administered by actual teachers.
Yes. So it'll be part of the curriculum.
Exactly, part of the curriculum. You're right, it's on first reading, when you look at what's being proposed to be looked at, you think to yourself, well, I don't know how they'll do that. But having said that, the topics that they are planning on covering, yes, we've only seen the broad brush strokes. But the topics that are planning on being covered are far more relevant to the modern world than the animals walked on the ark 2x2.
Exactly.
It really is a gigantic leap forward, and congratulations to the Victorian government. Now, that's the first state. Ladies and gentlemen, we have another 5 states and 2 territories to go yet.
Yep, but it's a great example that other states can now look at and say, well, you know what, overnight you can just make a decision and get rid of this nonsense. So, interesting, the Victorian Opposition Education spokesman Nick Wakeling said that the Premier had broken a pre-election promise about SRI, creating chaos for parents. And I'll quote him, he says, "This decision by Daniel Andrews will create chaos for thousands of parents whose children will be forced to attend these classes out of school hours," he said. "Parents in schools across Victoria will face the prospect of juggling new and varied after-school hours pickups just to suit the ideological whims of Daniel Andrews." Yeah, I don't think he gets it.
It was no different to my mum and dad taking me to bloody tennis lessons. You know, it was...
Yeah, you know, if you've got a keen interest in your kid being indoctrinated into a faith, then that's what Sundays... That's what Sundays are for. And
exactly. I mean, they're just clutching at straws, aren't they?
Yeah, but, you know, to suit the ideological whims. I mean, only 20% of Victorian kids actually went to SRI.
And, so you had 80% that were twiddling their thumbs or at best reading a book.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah, it's not put thousands into chaos. That's just... And it, also, it's not going to be chaotic anyway. As an adult, they'd be able to sit there and say, oh, okay, well, next January I'll have to do something... Next February I'll have to do something different if I want the kids educated that way.
Yes.
So they've got time to prepare for it, you know.
Yep. But Pyrrhus has been, you know, battling hard over the years. I mean, originally... It was an opt-out program, so that if you didn't do anything on the enrolment form, then your kid was automatically in special religious instruction. And then it did change to opt-out. And lo and behold, overnight, when that change occurred, the enrolments in special religious instruction dropped by 42%. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. Incredible, really.
So, you know, there's no general clamouring for this sort of thing. And if people want their kids to do it, then do it at Sunday school or do it in your own time. Don't do it in public school.
I personally think that a lot of the roll-up to the SRI, whether it be Queensland, New South Wales or Victoria, always was just parents taking the path of least resistance.
Yeah, yep.
You know?
And, you know, what will happen in all of the arguing and what religious people, you know, will say is that, you know, this is breaching a long-standing tradition of, you know, special religious instruction in schools in Australia, and, you know, this breach of tradition and what's always been done is what they'll talk about. But that's not actually the case. So just to give people a little bit of history... prior to Federation, when we were just a bunch of colonies, and this is the case in Queensland, but pretty much all other states follow in a very similar sort of timeline. But basically, in the 1870s, the state's education was some religious-based schools and a few state-run schools, and the government at the time recognised that this just wasn't working, and that they needed a free, compulsory and secular education system. So all of the states in around the 1870s totally withdrew state funding of religious schools, and that did not return until 1963. So in terms of actual funding of religious schools, there was about 100 years that it didn't happen. Now, in relation to the special religious instruction classes, where a volunteer or a priest or an imam or somebody else can wander into a school and proselytize for an hour, that was also banned from 1875 to 1910. Now, that's in a period when 95% of people were Christians, and it was banned in that time. And it basically came back into effect because of fears of communism. But then, interestingly, Scott, in the 1970s, virtually all the states had internal reviews or external reviews of the special religious instruction classes, looking at whether they were appropriate or not, and all of them recommended that instead of these indoctrination classes, they should be replaced with general religious education where you learn about all faiths and secularism and the whole bunch of things, the sorts of things that the secular party argues for now. So in the 1970s, all of the states had reviews, and all the reviews said, let's get rid of SRI, and it's only taken 45 years for it to actually happen, because what you had was, conservative governments like the Bjelke-Petersen government and others who didn't like the idea and who just, surprise, surprise, just ignored the recommendations of the inquiries. So these classes have been going against the grain of Australian society for a long time, and if you hear somebody talk about, we've always done it and it's a tradition, then why do we have to break with tradition? Well, you now know the arguments as to why that's not actually true.
Absolutely. And, this is simply what Andrew's government is doing, is simply doing what should have been done, as you said, 45 years ago.
Yeah. So.
And I fail to see why, if a society now that's probably less than 50% Christian, and then probably an even smaller percentage of that who are regular church attenders, why a society now couldn't cope with something that was seen quite normal and natural in 1900 and whatever it was,
yes,
could cope with. And hence why I was so excited. It is a gigantic leap forward.
Yep.
So I... Full marks, Mr. Andrews.
Yes.
We'll see how the rest of the government goes, but that's on this particular issue, well done.
And full marks to Firis, and it makes it easier now for the other states. So
exactly. It's been done once,
yep.
So now it will be easier. So we're
wearing my secular party spokesman's hat. I've asked for a meeting with the Queensland State Education Minister Kate Jones, and
she's actually your MP, isn't she?
She is, so she's my local
yes.
MP, and it'll just make it so much easier to say, hey, Victoria's done this, it's not that hard, how about we do the same here? So so when that meeting occurs and I get an answer, dear listeners out there, you'll be the first to know. But one of the things in that whole process that we just talked about was how when the opt-out method changed to opt-in, the attendance figures plunged by 42%, which just goes to show how you frame a form can make a big difference to
in the result.
To what happens. And on that score, we've got our second piece of great news in the secular world for the week, which was in relation to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Scott, you want to take this one?
I'll take this one. This one's probably not, it's probably not the perfect outcome, but you know what? It's probably, what do you reckon, 80-90% there?
Pretty good.
It is pretty good. So previously, if you remember 4 years ago when you had to fill out your census form, you got to question, I think it was question 26, and it said, what is your religion? And you went through Anglican, Catholic, blah, 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 right down to the end, and then you found none. So,
yes.
Of course...
Well, after other, I think it would have other, so you could write
it was
in
even after other, was
Jedi
it?
Knight right or Pastafarian or...
exactly, yeah.
And then underneath that was none.
Mm-hmm, okay, well, I stand corrected. So that was the way it was done. In the next census, which is next year, I don't know what date it is, but at some stage during the 2016 year, there will be a census. And when it comes to the religious question, it will ask, what is your religion? And the first of the list is none. So before you get down to all the others, it will say none.
Technically, Scott, I know you don't have the form in front of you because of problems, but it technically says no religion.
Okay.
And then
no religion.
There's a little, which is has a little like a lozenge type space that you would mark with your pencil. And then there's a sort of a slightly bigger space, and then the most popular religions are listed: Catholic, Anglican, United Church, Presbyterian, Buddhism, Islam, Greek Orthodox, Baptist, Hinduism, and then other underneath that. So that's the way it's going to be phrased as question 19 in the next census. So they had no religion as the first option.
Now, why this is such an improvement on the last census is that previously you'd go through the list and you'd think to yourself, well, gee, Mum had me baptised in the Church of the Holy Mother of the Perpetual Exemption, therefore I must be that.
Yes.
Whereas now, even though it's been a very long time since someone might have sprinkled holy water on your forehead that you don't remember, you will probably be inclined to say, well, actually, I don't have a religion.
Well,
where this becomes really important now, listeners, is that rather than Jim Wallace and Wendy What's-Her-Name from the Australian Christian Lobby being able to say to people in Canberra, we represent the views of however many million Christians in Australia, they will be able to, the non-religious groups, your atheists, your agnostics, your deists, will be able to turn around and say, well, actually, we're the ones in the majority, and our politicians are actually going to have to say, well, geez, maybe Jim Wallace is just full of hot air after all.
Exactly. So
that's why it's very important, and it's a great move forward. Why I said it wasn't 100% victory, I would have preferred if question whatever it was split into two parts where it said, do you have a religion, yes or no? If you ticked no, it then said go down to the next question, but if you ticked yes, it then asked which one.
Yes, that would have been the rolled gold solution,
but we've still got a very good outcome on that, so hence why I'm very happy.
Yep, and we've mentioned before in New Zealand, they've got, I believe, the are you religious, yes, no, and if yes, which type as their format, and with a pretty similar cultural background to us, they have no religion at 42%, whereas in the last census we were 22%. And Scott, I think amongst our group we're going to have some sort of bet or wager as to where the no religion figure is going to end up in Australia after the next census. And I'm thinking somewhere in the high 40s is going to be my bet.
Well, I'm thinking to myself it'll end up in the four in front of it. I don't think we'll crack the 50% mark. But of those 50% that are left behind as nominating a religion, you're going to have them broken down into those groups.
Yes.
So instead of the Christian lobby being able to turn around and say, we are representing the majority, you'll be able to point to cold facts that say, actually, no, you're not.
Yep. The no religion will be bigger than any single other religion, any single religion. Listed on
absolutely
there for sure. And we can be confident of that because other surveys that are done outside of the census, like there's Wind Gallup polls and polls by McCrindle Research. The Wind Gallup one had not religious at 58 and the McCrindle one had not religious at 48. So it's going to be a high figure for sure.
Well, that's interesting to know that one of the surveys came in at more than 50.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
that is interesting.
So two fantastic results in the week, and
It's certainly much better news than what it was the week before, wasn't it?
Yep, it was good. So they must have known it was my birthday, and they've come through with the goods. So
they have.
Yep.
Indeed they have.
Glove, I'm going to tell you, I'm just going to indulge me here for one little moment with a little bit of a joke, because it is my birthday. And
absolutely.
We have in our house a couple of boarders staying with us. One of them is a Chinese boy who's learning English, and his English is not that good. And my wife said to him a few days ago, look, it's Trevor's birthday coming up. It's a good idea to buy a birthday card just to give it to him. So tonight at dinner, he presented me with my birthday card, and as I said, his English is not that good. So I've opened up the card, and you know, I'm turning 50. I've turned 51, Scott. So I'm getting on, and the card.
Not ready for pasture yet.
Well, I'm not sure because the card starts with sympathy.
And then when, and then I open the card and it says, "Thinking of you at this difficult time. Happy birthday to Trevor." Which I think makes it the best birthday card I've ever received. With with sympathy.
And, sympathy, yes.
And thinking of you at this difficult time. How good's that? So,
love it.
Enough of my birthday talk. The present from the Australian Bureau of Statistics and from the Victorian government, that's the icing on the birthday cake. So,
absolutely, yeah.
So, moving away from that secular issue for a moment, and we've got other secular issues to come back to, but, oh, my God, is Joe Hockey the worst treasurer in a long, long time?
Well, it's, yeah, you scratch your head. I mean, it comes back to, I don't know which podcast it was where we were talking about how the government has no overreaching narrative. And, you know, initially they were telling us all, we have this budget emergency, everything's falling apart, it's a disaster. So what he did then was he had a little thought bubble, which presumably was trying to soften the electorate up for, you know, an election will be due next year sometime, presumably after about July or August next year, so that the Senate doesn't have, so it can just be a half Senate election as well. So he started talking about tax cuts. Well, his thought bubble went a little more serious this week, and he had a room full of important business people.
Hmm.
I forget where it was. I believe it was delivered in Sydney. And he had a speech basically telling everyone about the importance of having personal income tax cuts.
Yep.
Because that will help stimulate the economy. Now, okay, granted, he's right. You know, and it's not a very popular view, but when you listen to economists, they will, almost all of them will argue that by having personal tax on people, income tax, that does have a slower, that does help slow the economy down. So his argument that by cutting income taxes, he will be able to stimulate economic growth and so on and so forth. But the problem with that is if you have a lower tax rate, even what Canberra is going to get as a share of whatever economic growth comes in is going to be lower. So in order for him to repair a structural deficit, he's still going to have to do some fairly savage expenditure cuts. And we all remember how that went in the 2014-2015 budget. So, again, I honestly think it comes back to this, is he mad? Well, you know, you'd think he would have been diagnosed by now. But just not having I would even go as far to say that he doesn't fully understand the brief of what he's actually supposed to do. Because if there is actually genuinely this budget emergency, what they had been relying on, and listeners, there is a link to a Drum article. I'm just trying to find. Miranda Stewart was the author of it.
Yep.
And she's pulled it apart.
Great argument. She gives a really good expose.
Absolutely. The whole nuts and bolts are there. You can read that and come out an expert afterwards. I'll leave you to decide which, you know, whether or not you agree with her final analysis, but there's no argument. She's certainly got the numbers on the table to back up her argument.
Yeah.
Well, where she's pulled it apart was she has, and the argument against Hockey delivering tax cuts was laid down in his 2015-16 budget, where he says we've got a credible path to surplus. Well, now we look at what his path to surplus is, and it relies on what's called bracket creep.
Yep.
Now, bracket creep is that with, you know, most of our wages do go up each year based on, you know, you hope a little bit more than CPI, but the point is, as your salary goes up, because we're on a progressive scale of taxes, you end up paying a little bit more tax each year because your income has risen. That's bracket creep.
Mm.
And where bracket creep hurts is when, well, say your first, I can't remember whether rates kick in, but say your first $100,000 you pay X dollars, and that next $1,000 over $100,000 you pay 45 cents in the dollar on that $1,000, whereas before you might pay 38.
Yep.
So you could get pushed into a higher bracket. Therefore, while you might get $1,000 gross, you're only going to keep $550 of it. Anyway, that's a long-winded way. But if you look at the graphs and everything that were presented back in the 15-16 budget, it's quite clear that they were relying on bracket creep to return the budget to surplus. Then if you start talking about having income tax cuts, well, bang goes bracket creep. So where's this credible path to surplus now?
Well, he said himself in the 2014-15 budget that, you know, the stuff in there would make personal personal tax cuts much more likely in 4 or 5 years' time, end quote.
And that was only 2 years ago.
And a lot of the expenditure cuts were not enacted because they couldn't get through the Senate.
No, they're stalled in the Senate.
So, A, he said back then it's going to take 4 or 5 years, and then B, the stuff he was relying on in terms of expenditure cuts didn't go through, and C, he was also relying on pretty optimistic growth, which isn't happening. Mm-hmm. So it is just a blatant run-up to an election, throw some, you know, some popularist money and hope that will help pick up a few percentage points in the polls, because it's not done for any creditable economic reason. And
I'd even go as far as to say that I don't even think he's promising money, to be honest. I think he's probably just trying to put the idea out there that you will get tax cuts if you return a coalition government. Don't worry about it, they're there. But they've not talked numbers, they've not talked timing or anything like that. This is just it's government by soundbite with this lot.
Yeah.
You've got, you know, we want lower, simpler, fairer taxes. Okay, that's great. What sort of lower, simpler, fairer taxes are you talking about? Well, let's palm it off to the states and make them do the heavy lifting. There will be a link to an interview. I think it was an ABC interview with Saul Eslake. Saul Eslake's a very well-respected economist, and he makes a very compelling argument for having a decent conversation about tax reform.
Yep.
You know, because if you are going to hand out income tax cuts, the long overdue conversation the country's got to have is, do we want a sort of Scandinavian-style system where you pay higher amounts of income tax, but you've got almost cradle-to-grave welfare in that whatever happens, you will be looked after?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you want a much lower income tax system and sort of be completely reliant on yourself and your family? So we've got to have that conversation.
Yep.
Now, I suspect that we're probably going to lean towards further along the Scandinavian scale, maybe not go as far as that, but I don't think we want the sort of winner-take-all, survival-of-the-fittest regime that tends to dominate the North American continent.
In terms of the spectrum, I'd rather be at the Scandinavian end than the United States of America end, that's for sure.
Absolutely, you know.
But a couple of other things in this article. So what Joe Hockey said was he raised the concern about earners who face the top rate leaving the country to pay lower taxes. Well, leave the country and go. We don't want you if you think the tax rate's too high. Like, if you want a level of civilization, you do need to pay tax. And if you think it's better in the Philippines, then away you go. Like, goodbye. So,
not only that, you live in countries for other reasons other than the level of income tax you pay.
Exactly. And
being able to breathe the air, drink the water, those things.
Yep, and I think people will pay more tax to live in this country because of what it offers. And the other thing he talked about was he referred to New Zealand and lauded them because they've got a much lower top rate of 33%.
Hmm.
But what he didn't mention was that there's no tax-free threshold.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's taxed from their first dollar. There's no work mm-hmm. deductions, and there's almost no concessional superannuation. So he's just picked out top rate 33%. We should aim for that because New Zealand's got it, without mentioning all the other things that have to go with it. Like, that's just pathetic.
Yeah, I mean, again, I'll come back to, you know, if we were to have this conversation where all those things were on the table, then you can argue whether or not it's a good idea or a bad idea to have a tax-free threshold. I personally think it's a good idea. However, I can see why New Zealand doesn't have concessional superannuation.
Yes.
They also have a universal age pension.
Yep.
So, you know, if we want to have a conversation about superannuation versus a universal pension, let's have that conversation.
Yeah.
But to sort of pick it and say New Zealand's clearly got it right because they've got the top marginal rate lower than us,
yep,
but ignore those things, yeah, you've hit the nail right on the head. New Zealand is not just a top marginal rate thing you've got to look at. You've got to look at the whole picture.
Yes.
And again, over here, we can't just have a tax debate that is in isolation saying, let's tax health, let's tax food, if you don't discuss the other things. And those elephants that are in the room are negative gearing concessions, are concessions for superannuation. And also, you know, what a lot of people don't realise is that when you get a superannuation pension out of your privately funded superannuation fund, you can earn, I think it's up to 250 grand completely tax-free.
Yeah.
So I'm a bit mystified as to why income should be treated differently if you're aged over 60 as opposed to being under 60.
Yeah, I mean, these are all the things that should be discussed that aren't. But just quickly back to New Zealand. They actually take in more income tax as a percentage of GDP than Australia does. So
listeners, go have a look at that graph. Yeah. It's a very interesting one. You can see what the percentage of GDP is personal income tax.
Yes.
And we're up there, but we're not too bad, to be frank.
Yeah. And, you know, it's all what do you get in return is the question as well. So, you know, can you go to a hospital and be looked after and things like that? That's what you need to know. So, and the article finally has, you mentioned briefly, you know, in terms of the different taxes on different forms of income, and there's a great chart there that assumes somebody's on the marginal tax rate of 32.5% and they've got an opportunity to invest in different areas, assuming a 6% return in those areas, and just the different effective tax rates on investments is crazy. I mean, your own home, zero tax. Property works out about 15. Domestic shares is less than 10%. Foreign shares is about 20%, and superannuation is actually no tax.
Negative, yeah.
And so all these other ways of earning money are taxed far cheaper than income tax. So these are all the things that have to be talked about. You know, why should these incomes be taxed less than personal exertion income? You know, but of course, you know, call me cynical, but I just see Hockey and Abbott really pandering to the wealthy constituents in their. It just looks clearer and clearer to me that they're not interested in average Joe or the wealth. You know, the lobby groups who look after the wealthy interests are really very successful in talking to Joe Hockey and putting thought bubbles in his head.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, like, I think, I can't remember if it was you or me, one of us made the point on a couple of podcasts ago that the new right has forgotten that it's the market that provides consumers and it's consumers that provide business opportunities, not business itself.
Yeah.
Business is in response to the market. The market is made up of the household sector. Therefore, this sort of pandering to business is not the right way forward. You need to have a strong market of reasonably remunerated consumers to actually have a strong economy. And to continually bend over backwards for mining billionaires who shall remain nameless, it's not sustainable. In the longer term, you have to have people that can afford to eat, drink, be merry, and clothe their children.
Yep.
You know,
because and the lower middle classes, they'll spend it all. They'll spend it all in Australia, and it'll run around a few times. So, Anyway, that's Joe Hockey, who is increasingly disappointing.
He really is increasingly disappointing, and for a man that was actually taken seriously at one point as a potential leader of the Liberal Party, I really thought he'd have more brains than that. I mean, kudos to him for being part of the push for an Australian head of state today, but still in all, he hasn't done a hell of a lot else to inspire confidence.
Yeah, yep. But next topic that's come up during the week is the potential for Australia to start bombing Syria. And,
That's mission creep, isn't it?
And, you know, well, what we've got is supposedly the United States have asked Australia to become involved in bombing in Syria. But you know what, Scott? Like, as sure as eggs, Tony Abbott wants to expand our involvement, either for maniacal ideological reasons or because he figures war is good for incumbent governments, or both. And I bet you that he has had discussions with the US and says, hey, you know what, we'd really like to up our involvement. Maybe you could ask us to be more involved. Can you do that for us? And that's what's happened.
And I suspect that what has happened. I mean, the only thing that makes this sensible is that at least he hasn't said we're going to send over another half dozen Super Hornet jets. It's going to be done with the defence assets that are already there now.
Wow.
So it's, but the problem is this could be the thin end of the wedge too, that, you know, it might just start now and then the next thing you know, you're going to need extra personnel and so on and so forth.
Yep.
Big problem I have is that the United States is able to act over Syrian airspace and bomb them and that sort of stuff, principally because they are not a signatory to the International Criminal Court.
Yep.
So even if they do commit a war crime, it's very hard to hold them to account. Their personnel can't end up in The Hague on the wrong side, in the dock over there at The Hague. We are a signatory to the International Criminal Court.
Yep.
So if our guys do drop ordnance and do hit a village of civilians rather than armed militia, we could find our blokes facing lengthy prison sentences in Europe. So that, to me, is the first hurdle. The second thing is, look, Bashar al-Assad is not a nice guy, but while he's a nasty dictator, at least he's a secular nasty dictator. You know, and I'd rather deal with this. At least a secular dictator understands that he's got a life,
right,
and that he's more likely to be coaxed into retirement somewhere else. But someone who honestly believes that if he stands and fights, will have a better life in an afterlife. Yeah, I'd rather deal with the secular idiot than the religious moron.
Mm.
So we're probably, if you're going to engage in airstrikes over Syria, some will say I'm swearing for suggesting this, but maybe it's time to actually pick up the phone to President Assad and say, look, we haven't spoken to you for years, but do you mind if we drop bombs on your territory?
that's the phone call that should have been made. I mean,
absolutely.
I mean, because the thing is, Iraq has expressly requested assistance, but Syria hasn't.
Yes.
So
exactly.
That's the big difference. And it, you know, Tony Abbott talks about, oh, you know, such a big cultural shift to have gay marriage. We need a plebiscite. Well, it's a big cultural shift to start bombing Syria when it hasn't asked for help. Like, you're happy to make that decision. He runs the arguments that suits him.
Agreed. And the other thing that I do think that we have got very lackaday about in the West is that when you do drop smart bombs and you can then have a video footage of it right down to the target and say, yeah, we were aiming for the door, see that? We got right in the middle of the door.
Yep.
What you don't see is what's left behind afterwards. From the air, it's just smashed bricks and cement.
Yep.
Someone on the ground's going to pull out the bodies.
Yep.
And not all those bodies are going to be armed men. Some of them are going to be children.
Yep.
And given that this is the sort of fight that it is, it's an ugly fight. There are going to be men. There's going to be unarmed men, unarmed women, unarmed children, and they are going to be, in that horrible term, collateral damage. Now, I'm not a pacifist. Sometimes push does come to shove. But this is a war that I don't think we can really improve things on the ground. I don't think we can win it. I think it's got to take resolve from the Arab world to win it. And when you had, I forget which city it was in Iraq, was it Ramadi or was it Mosul that fell?
Yeah.
And basically what it was the Iraqi army outnumbered the insurgents 10 to 1. Oh. They were in pre-prepared defensive positions,
yep,
and they still retreated.
Yep.
Now, if the Iraqi army isn't going to put skin in the game, why the hell should Western mums and dads send their sons and daughters,
yep,
to put skin in the game?
Yep.
You know,
I think it was more like 30 to 1. And whole issue,
it was even that high.
The whole issue, yeah, was that Shiites couldn't really be bothered, recovering Sunni territory.
Yeah.
From, you know, they didn't care because that's a Sunni area. Why spill blood for Sunnis? So until, yeah, that whole sectarian issue is in the framework, then it's just putting Band-Aids on gunshot wounds, and we end up getting yeah, covered in blood.
Exactly. And at the end of the day, and this is something my better half pointed out to me. He says it doesn't matter who wins; they're both going to hate us.
Yes.
So it seems to me that we've got so little to gain from this.
Yep.
And, you know, great, the Iraqis have asked for help. That's fine. But unless their army is prepared to, you know, I do think that's a conversation that Obama and Abbott should have had with, what's his name, Maliki, isn't it? They should have said to the Iraqi prime minister, hey, look, when your guys stand and fight, we'll stand with them.
Yep.
But if they're not going to fight, why the hell should we bother?
Yeah. Yep.
You know, I mean, look, the Islamic State is an absolutely disgusting organization. What it's done is repulsive in the extreme. But if those that have got the most to lose from an Islamic State takeover aren't prepared to put themselves in harm's way to prevent it, why on earth should the young men from France, Germany, the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, New Zealand, and everywhere else put themselves in harm's way?
Yeah.
I'm becoming less inclined to support it, considering that the locals aren't seeming to put up a decent fight.
Yep, it's something for the countries in the area to deal with. And, you know, I know there's been this argument that, you know, George Bush kind of walked into a bar room and started a fight, and then Obama kind of walked into the bar room and just sat down in the corner and did nothing. And we kind of walked into the bar room with George Bush and sort of started the fight with him. So we've, you know, it's our job to finish the fight. But I say that bar room was full of people with guns and knives, and at any moment they were all about to jump on top of each other, and there was kerosene lying around, and you know, it's not like it was you know, all lovey-dovey and happy times in that bar room before.
This was not a bar in Geneva.
Yeah, so yes, you know, we might have struck the light that set it off, but it was going to go off in some fashion or another. And personally, I'm prepared to walk through the swinging doors of the bar room, of the saloon, out into the street and go back home. That's what I'd like us to do.
Well, to my way of thinking also, and you know, this is the callous accountant in me coming out, is that we're going to be expending an awful lot of money in jet fuel and explosives and everything else. We might be better off finding a part of the world over there that's relatively peaceful, that's happy to house an internationally funded United Nations run refugee facility. And we might be better off pouring money into that and providing providing doctors and food aid and that sort of stuff. And then,
well, closer to home, you know, Myanmar and all that sort of stuff. Like, all that money, let's spend it on getting refugees here and looking after them. Like, let's do that.
Well, yeah.
That'll be something positive. Yeah. And it's in our neck of the woods, so it's appropriate for us to be involved. And, you know, we as a small country are just becoming known as, you know, some sort of mercenary outfit. We'll sidle up with the US whenever we're asked to and get involved in all sorts of conflicts where we've got no business being.
Absolutely. You know, and once I've finished reading From Sacred to Secular, very good book. Yes, this is a blatant plug, listeners. We love the book and we want you to go and buy it.
Mm.
Once I finish reading to that, I'm going to go and read Malcolm Fraser's last book, Dangerous Allies, I believe it's called.
Actually, before, you can't do that, Scott, because I've got a different one for you. I've got Marion Maddox, Taking God to School, The End of Australia's Egalitarian Education, and some of the little history.
Oh, yeah, I had been meaning to read that work.
Yeah, so some of the little history I gave before was as a result of that and other things. So that's your next book. Malcolm Fraser will have to...
he'll have to go down to the third position.
Yep. So
but yeah, from the excerpts I've read from it, listeners, he sounds like he got it.
Yeah.
He understood that maybe those alliances that we all signed up to with the Russia blood in the head in the 40s, they may be no longer relevant in 2015.
Definitely. He was an advocate of unhinging our relationship with the US.
Yeah, and, you know, there's a strong argument for that. And I think he even advocated well and truly after he'd retired and gone from, you know, the hawk of the right through to the very much the centrist man that he became before he died. He advocated, he said that probably the sensible thing to do was after the Berlin Wall had come down, that NATO and CETO and ANZUS and all the rest of it could have been disbanded.
Mm. Yep.
They were no longer appropriate. Anyway, that's probably off topic. I apologise for going there. But
yeah, no, that's all right. But moving on, now I've got some statistics here from Essential Report, Scott.
Ah, and this is the one you didn't want me to
read. So,
you wanted to surprise
so
me.
So listeners, okay.
Surprise me.
Scott and I do communicate before the podcast and send articles, etc. to each other. And this is one I sent to Scott, and then I quickly sent him a note saying, oh, don't look at those because I just want to sort of test you on what you think of some of this. So so Essential Report does polling of Australians, and I've mentioned them before, and two-party preferred. They've got Labor at 51, Liberals at 49, and in the sort of first preference voting, they had other/independent moving in recent weeks from 8% to 9% to 10%. So it looks like the Secular Party's picked up a couple of percentage there in the other independent. But
and I honestly believe it is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove set podcast that's having a big impact on that.
I think so. But same-sex marriage, people were polled as to should same-sex couples be allowed to marry, and what they did was break it up amongst people who vote Labor, Coalition, Greens or other.
Yeah.
So Scott, overall,
it's the test, is it?
Overall, should same-sex couples be allowed to marry? How many would say yes, and how many would say no overall, and how many would be don't know?
Overall, it'd have a 7 in front of it. I'm thinking to myself, 71-72% would be in favour of that proposition. I'd say opposed would be less than 20, and then don't knows would be under 10.
Not bad news for you, Scott.
Yeah, I was wrong, huh?
Overall, should not be allowed to marry. Should be allowed to marry is 60%.
Okay.
Should not be allowed to marry is 31%.
Is that right?
Mm. So, you know, just breaking it up amongst the groups, someone like, if you're a Green supporter, then you'll be a 91% likely to be in favour of gay marriage. No surprise there.
Yeah.
If you're a Labor supporter, you'll be 73% in favour of allowing gays to marry. Coalition? Well, 45% would be in favour of gay marriage, and 44% would be against.
Yeah.
But interestingly, so in all of those four categories, the yes should be allowed to marry are greater than the no should not be allowed to marry. But the category where that's not the case is in other. So in the other column, which I guess is your Palmer United and your Catter Party and your, is the Hanson, Pauline Hanson Party still going? But there's Family First and Secular Party, etc. In that other category, 45% say should not be allowed to be married, and only 42% say that they should. So,
in that other group, though, you're going to have the Family First, which is basically a wholly owned subsidiary of Hillsong.
Right.
You're going to have Family First. You're going to have Pauline Hanson, Bob Catter. So of that other group, they're probably more on the conservative side rather than the progressives, like the Secular Party, the Future Party, they are of the progressive ilk, and we're going to be all lumped into the others.
Yes.
But
there's a few conservative elements in that other category.
Absolutely. Yeah, there are. And, because the hard right feels disenfranchised as much as the sensible centre does.
But anyway, so, Scott, only 60% in favour of being allowed to marry, which I thought was an interesting figure.
I was very surprised at that, because any of the polling I had read prior to this was coming solidly in the early 70s, in the 70s. It does make me wonder if all the breathlessness and hyperbole that went on over the last few weeks is maybe... And was that a successful ad campaign? I don't know if you saw the Iceberg ad about there's more to same-sex marriage than meets the eye. Whether or not that's had an impact.
Yep.
But I am very surprised that it's down there in this early 60s.
Yeah. But then there's another...
It's still...
There's another interesting question here, which I'm going to test you on, is... Okay. Do you think the issue of same-sex marriage should be decided by Parliament, or should there be a national vote? Now, Scott, how many people think it should be decided by Parliament, and how many think there should be a national vote?
Look, I'm really guessing here, seeing I got it so wrong the first time, but I'm thinking to myself that it's probably going to be about the same numbers. Those who are opposed probably want the national vote. Those who are in support probably want Parliament to deal with it. So I'm thinking probably 60% favour Parliament, 40-odd percent favour the...
Okay, so it was 60-30 and 10 don't knows on the other question. So, okay, well, 66% think there should be a national vote, and only 22% say it should be decided by Parliament. So...
Okay. I was wrong again.
So... And despite our best efforts to convince the population, Scott, because I think we've been pretty pro the idea that Parliament should just pass it, we're not making much headway.
We're not cutting through.
Yes.
Yeah. So I even had friends of mine that are in favour of same-sex marriage saying, well, we've got this vote, let's just get out there and win it. And I just think to myself, the problem is, and I have said this on a number of podcasts, is... The problem is the unhinged element of the Australian Christian lobby is going to get out there and they're going to say some absolutely disgusting stuff over the next couple of years. It's going to be ugly. And that is what my major objection is to a popular vote, is that it's going to allow the unhinged element to get out there and say God only knows what.
Well, Scott, when do you think that vote should take place? Before the next election? On the same day as the next election? Or after the next election?
look, I was very disappointed when Malcolm Turnbull lost the leadership of the Liberal Party. He wants to vote before the election, so I'd have to put myself in that category.
Okay.
But I would imagine that you got similar numbers again saying let's have it after the poll, would they?
No. In fact, only 11% want it after the next election. So 35...
So they want it sorted now.
35 want it before, and 43 want it at the same day as the next election. So only 11% want it protracted, drawn out sometime in 2 years' time sort of thing. So that's good news.
Well, that is good news. I mean, I'd still reckon it's for the Parliament to fix, and the Parliament should just... Look, even though it's only 60% in favour, that is still a solid majority. I mean, none of the parties have got 50% of the primary vote.
Yep.
So if you've got 60% of the public saying yes, then surely it's time for Parliament to go with it anyway.
Yeah. So, and just briefly, a couple of other things. Royal Commission into Trade Unions, 27% thought it was a political attack on Labor, 39% said it was legitimate, and 34% don't know. And as to whether Dyson Heydon has a conflict of interest, 38% said yes there is, and 25% no there isn't, and 37% said I've got no idea. So I like the Essential report, and there's a link to that, and I thought they were all interesting statistics there.
Yeah, it proves how I'm just not in touch with the zeitgeist, am I?
So other things that people have looked at. Now, I've been banging on for a while now about the ABC religious programs, Scott. And there's about eight of them on the radio that all deal with religious issues, and not a single one.
Do tell me, before you go too far, did 612 get back to you about giving you a slot?
No response.
Okay.
So I did... contacted them twice recently. One was about that obscene interview with the fellow who wrote the book about the Bible, and I said, happy to give account of you. And then I also contacted them and said, the Bureau of Statistics has got a new format for the religion question. Happy to talk about that. And no response to that either. So I'm not making much headway there.
We're going to have to get Brian Moss on the ABC, to talk about his book.
Brian Morris,
Brian Morris, I apologise. Look, his book, I may have mentioned in the past, From Sacred to Secular.
Yep. So he'll help out. When I've come back from my holiday, we'll talk to Brian and he'll help us out. But another... So on that topic, the BBC in the UK has similar issues, where they've got a bunch of religious programs. And there was a review done by the BBC Trust, which found that, quote, programs on religion are the least popular offering from the station's programming in terms of claimed listening, and also, quote, the least well-received of all their programs. So
not only are they popular, but those people that do listen to it get angry.
So the secular sort of lobbyist over there are challenging this, and I think there's a Mr. Evans from one of the secular groups over there said, to have a slot in the middle Radio 4's flagship news and current affairs program reserved only for religious speakers to make sometimes very contentious points which go completely unchallenged is unjustifiable. It demonstrates an unhealthy and anachronistic deference to religion, unworthy of Britain's public service broadcaster. And I reckon...
I was just wondering, are you moonlighting writing for this band? Or?
So I just love his words there. It's they're great, aren't they? And I mean, you could say the exact same thing about the ABC.
About the ABC, yeah. And look, it's absolutely right. It's... I'll put on my economic rationalist hat, but this is what happens when you have a taxpayer-funded organisation that doesn't have to actually be popular.
Well, I'll put on my, iron fist hat and say that having an evangelical Pentecostal in charge doesn't help. So that's probably... that's what I think is how it's not helping anyway. So So,
but that's interesting because the ABC was modelled on the BBC, and you know they are having a similar sort of issue as what you've pointed out as what we are having the issue with. But also, the BBC is a much bigger organisation for sure, and it's it in some time spots it leads the ratings in the UK.
Yep.
So. Interesting that someone's gone and done that analysis.
I just love the way he says that, you know, they raise very contentious points which go completely unchallenged. That's the thing that gets me. I, you know, if there's just no... Hang on a minute. You can't... There's none of that happening with the religious views that get thrown out there. So I like that.
And when they have, you know... Sorry, what's the new rule? We've got to call them fariologists. When they have a fariologist turn up on Q&A... Yeah. Even though some of the other guests might have this incredulous look on their face, they don't actually say anything.
Yes, yeah.
You know?
So, yeah, our rule is we say, if we're going to say theologian, we have to say theologian / theriologist. So so that's our rule. I'm going to talk... I'm just going to diverge back briefly, Scott, to...
Absolutely.
The special religious education, because... I forgot to mention in that whole history of it that I mentioned in the mid-70s that there was a review to try and have it changed into a proper examination of all religions. And I found this, which I wasn't aware of before, but in 2006, Queensland Labor proposed putting philosophy in as part of the SRI. And... this is in 2006, and the Federal Education Minister, Julie Bishop, threatened to cut funding if it went ahead.
Yeah,
she said,
I remember that report.
We provide billions of dollars of funding each year for education in Queensland, she said. It's fair enough that we have our say on the issue of RI. Her rationale was that the changes would open the floodgates of paganism and witchcraft. And this is the part I like. The Humanist Society responded that pagans and Wiccans, being a religious denominational society, would already be permitted to offer SRI. Which is just fantastic. So, you know, you've got to understand these people's motivations. Like, I wasn't aware that Julie Bishop was of that ilk. You know, we weren't aware before that Scott Morrison is as red hot as he is. Like... it's important to know the motivations of these people. So,
I didn't know that Julie Bishop was a godmother. I just thought she was an arch conservative.
Yeah, well, you know, she was worried about the floodgates opening for paganism and witchcraft. So,
yeah, but when you read about demons and everything like that in the Bible, I mean, what else is that? It's witchcraft, surely.
So, so anyway, so there was that on her, and then just another anecdote. I mean, Mark Latham has been in the news of late because he had...
for all the wrong reasons.
So he had a bit of a brain explosion in the literary week in down south. And
Melbourne Writers Festival, I believe, is where his meltdown actually was.
So he's abused all sorts of people left, right and centre, and has subsequently resigned from his column on the Fin Review. But I just wanted to... it just gives me an excuse to tell a story because somebody said to him at one stage about Kevin Rudd and said, oh, you know, I think Kevin Rudd's a pretty decent fellow. And Mark Latham's response was, well, you obviously have never met him. Which I just thought was a great... just a great way of of putting his insult out there. His response was, yeah, well, you obviously haven't met him. So, people have said, you know, he's a bit of a nasty man, Mark Latham, but occasionally he would come out with a little gold nugget of some sort, and I reckon that one on Kevin Rudd was probably one of the ones that they were thinking of when they were...
It was a very accurate response, though, wasn't it? You've never met the man, I take it. Yeah.
So
he's a
sorry.
Funny bloke. He was an interesting bloke, and he had some very good ideas, but they never went anywhere because they came from Mark Latham.
Yes. Dangerous character. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So there we go, Scott. We've rattled through those issues, and I reckon, according to my calculations, we'll be somewhere near the hour mark by now.
We are very close, I would have thought.
Yeah, so... So I reckon our other issues we can, aren't time specific, we can roll them over till next week, folks. And so we hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and tune in next week. And I can't guarantee that the news will be as good as it was this week, but...
You never know, because I think we have turned the corner.
Right.
And that the news will now begin to improve.
Okay, well, I'll hold you to that velvet glove next time we talk, next week, which...
And I know it's a long time in advance, but listeners, when you do come to do your census form, do it online so that we can get the results nice and fast.
Very good. All right, Scott, that's good. We'll call that a wrap on that.
Good night, listeners.
Talk to you later, listeners, and thank you again for listening, and goodbye for now.
Have a great week. Bye now.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf, on their phone, and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.